Sounds
How
good.
How am I sounding?
That sounds a lot clearer.
Okay, and you sound clear too. So that's what happens when you mix up a cell and a Skype.
Yeah. All right, well, now we know.
Yeah, okay, well, we're ready to roll. However you would like to proceed here.
Okay.
And thank you very much for the opportunity to talk with you and share some views and information.
Yeah, I'm glad you were available. I spoke with Bill Ryan from Project Camelot this morning. Are you familiar with that site?
Which one is that?
Project Camelot.
I'm somewhat familiar. I have looked at that site. I have looked at some material on there. Not exhaustively.
Hello? Fred? 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 Can you hear me?
Hey, me, Todd.
There we go.
Okay.
Yeah, there was an interruption there. I was speaking to him about the possibility of organizing a disclosure event. And it would be for advanced energy in general and the kinds of suppression activities that have been ongoing. So that was thrown out there. There's an event in February in Barcelona where some of the folks who have been in the advanced energy realm will be discussing their experiences. But there's no centralized initiative for full disclosure of what's been happening. And personally, I feel at a loss as to how to centralize that effort. Do you have any suggestions?
Okay, so you're talking about a disclosure of advanced energy technology. This is not, or at least not directly related to what has been discussed on some of the websites and blogs about a UFO ET disclosure type event.
No, it would be completely separate.
This is a completely energy related.
Yeah.
Well, and what would, I guess the intent would be in part to try to achieve a higher, at least some broader public profile of this area of energy research and development?
Yes. I mean, it just proved to people that, one, the field of research is valid. Two, there are people actively working on it, some of whom have actually developed some of these advanced energy techs. And three, what can we do to support them in terms of funding, security, etc.?
Well, it seems to me, now how would that compare? I'm just kind of thinking through and talking through the idea, but there have been various of these conferences, some of which I've gone to. There was the one a few months ago that in the D.C. area. Did you go to that? That's the one. I think Tom Vallone was at least a co-organizer. The New Energy Movement was a co-sponsor of it. I think Joe Garbon was there.
Yeah. I didn't attend it. Dr. Vallone was nice enough to give me a copy of the proceedings, and I recorded his interview yesterday, but I still have to upload the video. It's a large file, so I haven't figured out how to do that yet, but hopefully by the end of today,
okay,
I'll have it up there.
So I guess what I'm, as we think through this possible disclosure idea, how would it differ from like a conference like that where I was at the two earlier ones in the prior years, you know, where there's a number of presentations by a number of researchers of their work and also some discussion of the overall lay of the land and so forth. How would you compare the disclosure event to these other conferences?
Well, it has to be free for anyone to attend and open to researchers, inventors, supporters who have experienced interference or who have something that they want to bring forward. It has to be completely transparent and open. And Vallone's event, the way he structures it, It's like a typical conference where you pay the entrance fee, and then the proceedings, either in book or DVD format, have to be purchased as well. And just to give you an idea, since our call started, we're now up to over 700 viewers. 800. Sorry, it just bumped up again.
Really? That's tremendous.
Yeah. So, I mean,
that is.
If it's open, you can have far more people participate than if you're charging even a small fee. I think that's absolutely critical.
So would you envision that this disclosure event, would it be done on an online basis, or would there be a physical, in the physical component as well, or what would your thought on that?
I think it should be both, because I'm sure there are people who would want to participate, but probably couldn't justify the expense to fly out to D.C. or drive out. When you do it that way, more people can be involved. And I've never seen that type of an event scheduled where you have people in person and people online participating, and it's free for everybody. No entrance fee, no access fee, nothing. Everybody it's free for, except the people organizing the event. And the location would determine the expense of the physical location. If it's a hotel, it's going to be pricey, you know, like up to $20,000 for a weekend. If it's just an open space like how Larry Jarboe did his event at the end of May or June of this year, I forget which month, that was free, aside from, you know, a couple bucks for parking.
So my general feeling is that that kind of activity would be helpful. Just to give you an example, the last couple of days, you tell me if I'm coming through okay, Todd. Is
sure.
This are people able to hear me okay on, as far as you know?
They must be. We're pushing almost 1,000 viewers. So
really, okay.
I guess this is working.
There's still some distortion in your voice coming through to me. It's sort of a little bit of the underwater effect, echo chamber effect. I'm just sharing that with you. That's
right.
The way it's. But I can make it out. So we're just going to go forward.
Yeah. Okay.
I was at a workshop the last couple of days on architecture of global change. This was organized in part by John Peterson and the Arlington Institute, which is a kind of a future study technology assessment, a type of organization. And John himself, he's done a lot of work for the military in the past, but he personally is very open to new energy, including over unity, a zero point, et cetera. But there was this was in the physical, okay? This is off premises. It was at Berkeley Springs, West Virginia. There was, 50 to 60 people there. Most of the people there, and these are people who spend a lot of time professionally looking at the future, if you wish, and they're looking at the total combined challenges facing the U.S. and the world. Very few of them have any significant awareness of new energy, the way you and I and the people on this call define it. And so, you know, they don't know they need education. I'm just giving you an example why anything that can raise the profile, you know, increases the chances of reaching a lot of key people and key organizations out there that might well be interested, but it's just not on their radar.
Right.
Or they can't tell the difference between conventional renewables. That's another thing. You know, for people that don't spend a whole lot of time on this, it could sound like the current administration is, you know, full speed ahead on new energy. But as you know, I've followed closely what ARPA-E, Advanced Research Projects Agency Energy, over in DOE has been doing, and they've now put $150 million in on new energy, and they put there's a solicitation on the street now for another $100 million, but it's, and they say it's transformational, but it isn't really out of the box. It's pushing things that are in the box this is my opinion and my interpretation, but to my knowledge, they haven't supported or even listed as an area the released a lot, most of the new energy items included within the new energy movement.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me even a little bit, but there's got to be a way to involve enough, a critical mass of people, so that this shows up on the radar. Because, like, this weekend event, that was just a short notice thing because I was somewhat perturbed at the fact that researchers are still being targeted for murder, literally. But we've got to reach a critical mass of people so we can garner enough support to move the R&D focus forward.
All right, so there's really two sides to this, it seems to me. On the one hand, on the positive side, there's much to be gained by greater public awareness, of this field of research, even though I know there's a great book by Gene Manning and Joe Garbon that came out, last year, and there's certainly been a number of really good conferences and so forth, but there's still, my impression anyway, is that, most of even the informed and active public and the activists in numerous other sectors still have very minimal, if any, awareness of this area. So there's much to be gained on that side. And then the other side that you're talking about, regrettably, is interference of various sorts with new energy researchers, especially the ones if they are coming up with things that look more promising. And that's on top of having to deal with the resistance from the scientific community and, a mental model problems and that sort of thing. It's hard enough to break through on some of those other areas without having to have, active interference and threats happening.
Right.
So hopefully, I guess the tack you're on, and I guess I would have to say give it a shot, because I do agree with what you said, that the more that this is out in the open and seen, the light is on, if you wish, should make it more difficult for negative events to happen. It doesn't guarantee they won't happen, but it should make it more difficult.
Right. Okay.
So I would be, bottom line is, based on this discussion up to this point, it would seem to me the concept is good, and I think the electronic part of it is a plus. That's something that couldn't have been done up until relatively recently, and it does allow a lot of people to tune in that wouldn't otherwise, because there's no question that the cost of travel and the time of travel, is an even bigger factor. It was always a factor, but the thing that I just went to was in the physical, in a rural area, actually, and there's things you can do face-to-face, and there's a lot of work groups and subgroups and all of that, so, there's a need for that, too, but on the other hand, that puts up huge barriers to a lot of people to participate.
Yeah.
So you do it, if you can do it, find a way to do it both ways, and it sounds good to me.
Okay. Since we're talking about the advanced stuff, do you want to briefly summarize what brought you into the advanced energy realm and some of the experiences and contacts you've had over the years?
Sure, I'd be happy to give that, and please ask questions. Interrupt. Don't hesitate to interrupt me if I start going on too long or get off track here. But, just as background, I've been in the field of technology assessment for 35 years, ever since graduate school. That's been my one line of my professional career, and I think but the viewers might be interested that I did work for about 17 years at the defunct, now defunct, but the Office of Technology Assessment for the United States Congress, which was a great experience because we were sort of a science and technology think tank within the political environment of Congress, and it was a great opportunity. And although I wasn't looking or looking at energy at that time, it was mostly in information technology. But it's the type of thing that, you know, needs to be done in all sectors. And unfortunately, that place eventually succumbed to political changes, even though there was a lot done to try to make it bipartisan protected. But the main point is, I'm coming at all of this from technology assessment and social impact analysis kind of perspective. So it's not only, you know, kind of from an engineering technical, but all the way up to macro level. So I just wanted to make sure everyone understands, you know, in that sense, I've been in the field generally for a very long time. But as far as new energy goes, I think I would demarcate that around 1997, maybe 1996, and what brought new energy into my radar, if you wish, on my radar screen, actually it was my dad, Fred Bernard Wood. I'm Fred Bruce Wood, and he at the time was out in the San Francisco Bay Area and was very ahead of his time and was tracking all sorts of things, and this came onto his radar back in the 90s sometime, and that's how it came into my awareness.
Okay.
And then I, you know, since then I've tracked it to various degrees. I will share with you that in the late 90s and very early 2000s, I did spend a fair amount of time with my dad kind of following up on some of the new energy suppression, threat, and interference situations that were brought to his attention. One of which was the Adam Trombley case, where his laboratory was reportedly destroyed. That would have been up in Oregon and some suburbs, I think, of Portland. And I'm just giving this as an example. I made some effort to try to follow up on that. Again, this would have been way after the fact. That's a problem. I mean, I was looking at this more than 10 years after it actually was reported to have happened. But I did learn, you know, these things are tough. It's tough if a lot of time has passed. It's tough. A lot of people that I found in that and some other situations are cautious about what they say. They, you know, kind of, who am I? You know, what am I going to do with the information? And can I trust you, sort of thing.
Right.
So, you know, I never really was actually able to properly, you know, investigate that particular case. I accepted it happened, but, you know, in terms of really unpacking it. But I, you know, I've had some exposure to some of these situations. I believe Mr. Trombley is in Hawaii, Maui at this time. That's my understanding. So anyway, lead me on. Ask me another question, or tell me where you want me to go with this.
Who else, what other researchers have you come across over the years that have been working on advanced energy, and what's their status, episodes of interference, that type of thing that just gives people a holistic overview of what these researchers have to deal with when they come across something that's truly revolutionary?
Okay, well, a couple of other ones that I, one of them that I looked at somewhat is the Bruce De Palma situation.
Okay.
And that's because some of his colleagues lived in the San Francisco Bay Area. I imagine they're still there, or out in California somewhere. And so there, it was really my dad. Again, a lot of this was happening through my dad, who passed over in 2006, just for the information of the people listening in here. But before that, you know, I was involved, you know, years before he passed on, and the De Palma situation was pretty well known, or very well known, in new energy circles in California anyway, and so there was some effort to you know, to look into that. Again, it's hard. Obviously, the facts, it was fairly easy to get the facts of the case, but, you know, in terms of what kind of subtle or not so subtle influences or pressures or may have been brought to bear on Bruce De Palma, you know, it's really hard, because already by then it had, again, been a number of years since that had happened by the time I was looking at it. I think what I want to do on this is bounce in and out, because there's a couple of themes I want to really emphasize.
Okay.
You know, I'll mention one other case, and I forget the person's name. It was somebody in Nevada. My dad and a colleague of his, Alden Bryant, runs the Earth Regeneration Society, and he and my dad were very close and, you know, did a lot of projects together. And I also would mention Tom Bearden, too, because Tom and my dad became aware of Tom Bearden's work, and it kind of brought me in, and I actually helped my dad visit Tom Bearden in Huntsville, Alabama. But that's just another piece, you know, of my awareness. You can, you know, hear, I know you're going to be hearing directly from Tom Bearden later on, but that's just another input that I've had, you know, in the new energy field, both positive and also, you know, interference or threat type information. There was a gentleman in Nevada, I forget the name, but it was another situation. So I'm just mentioning a few that I have looked at a fair amount. In some cases, I've actually tried to follow up and talk with some of the people, and in none of those cases did I ever talk with the principal. In you know, some situations they, you know, had passed on or had you know, moved way out of the area or were reluctant to talk. With the exception of Tom Bearden, I have talked you know, a fair amount with Tom. But the point I want to make, and I don't know if others have brought it up, but I do believe that, you know, the new energy researchers in general need to be much better prepared, to have better information, and really I've suggested some kind of a handbook or something for a personal security and protection side.
Dr. David Urth, I think he's a doctor, he's smart, should be, he said he's already written a manuscript that encompasses precisely that content to and he agreed to release it to Project Camelot's Kerry Cassidy and Bill Ryan. It'll be a PDF file, and assuming they're okay with the content and, you know, they all agree to post it, it would be available for immediate download with, you know, requested donations to, you know, compensate everybody for the time that they've taken to develop that and create an audience base and bring it to the public. So that could be available as early as, well, tonight if they start talking to each other. Otherwise, maybe later next week.
Okay, well, that's terrific. Cool. I'm sorry, I missed who you said had prepared that.
Dave Urth from Salt Lake City.
Okay. Yeah, well, that sounds terrific, because my impression, and I have gone over Gary Vesperman's paper, at least I've probably gone over 2 or 3 versions of it over the last few years, but you know, I think it will be of immense help if there can be a common body of knowledge shared broadly within the new energy community, and, as you know, researchers, entrepreneurs, inventors, whatever hats people are wearing here, even funders, you know, anybody who has a significant role in this would, I think, benefit from that. So that's terrific. I'll look forward to looking at that, and, you know, when I'll be give you my feedback once I have a chance to look at that document.
Okay.
The other thing, so I'm glad that's happening. The other point here that I want to make sure to get out here is about law enforcement. Now, this is about the protective and security. I know the purpose of this is somewhat emphasizing that side of it. And when you talk about disclosure, I guess you're talking about a disclosure event. That is both the what's actually happening in terms of research and development in the positive applications and potentials, as well as the threat and interference side of it. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay, so it's going to be both sides, because I think when you go to the broader audience, you know, it's really important to lead with the positive and what it, you know, what's at stake here, what is the potential of this area. Because I'm going to, when I was at this conference, everybody at this workshop I was at the last 2 days absolutely understands that energy is a key, a mission critical sector of the total U.S. and global future going forward. There's no doubt about that. Secondly, I think everybody recognizes that the status quo is not acceptable. And, you know, there's going to have to be significant changes. So there's no question, this is amongst the community of people who spend a lot of time on global futures and technology assessment, and, you know, they're in that sense, they're very up to speed. So there's no, you don't have to persuade them about the importance of the general topic. Where they're weak on is understanding the new energy piece of it. And that's where your type of event can really help on the positive. But they need a positive message. Then you talk about what's getting in the way of this potential being much more fully realized. Obviously, it's mostly potential right now.
Right.
And for a variety of reasons, and, you know, one of which is this threat interference type thing. So I just want to make sure that for that type of event, there's a positive, I would say a positive lead. But for this one, this weekend, another thing that I have been emphasizing is educating law enforcement.
Yes.
Has that come up? Has anybody else brought that up yet?
No, but that's a critical piece, because I don't think they understand why, you know, people, inventors, researchers call up saying, hey, somebody did this at my property, they're trying to get my technology. They don't really understand just how substantial those types of incidents are and how well orchestrated they are from the people who have the resources to carry out interference such as that which would involve law enforcement intervention.
Right. So, I'm getting an echo on my... Okay, it's off now. I'm hearing myself. I think it's probably not debatable that 99% of law enforcement does not have an energy background to begin with, nor do they have, you know, a technology background other than law. They're going to have information technology, law enforcement technology. Obviously, they're going to have familiarity with technology that's applied in the law enforcement realm. But, you know, the first thing is that they're not familiar with the subject matter. Or that's not the first thing, but that's an important piece of it. And so they don't have a context. The context that they bring is basically criminal law, and I guess to some degree it's mostly criminal law framework, and they're familiar with the range of traditional types of criminal activities and threats in criminal groups and organizations, and depending on the sophistication, they're going to be familiar with organized criminal activity, and some specialized law enforcement are going to be familiar with economic crimes. And, you know, some will understand so that if the stakes are high enough, you know, anything can happen.
Right.
So part of it, this is my feeling, is that it's it takes some work, but the first thing is to give in, to have law enforcement understand that this is potentially revolutionary in the energy sector. The energy sector is big. They probably understand that. You know, there's hundreds of billions or trillions of dollars in that sector. I think that's the kind of an approach. And then, you know, try to put the logic out there as to why people would be motivated to target new energy researchers and inventors and entrepreneurs. Okay, so that's kind of part of it. And then I think it needs to be, actually, if you have a couple of attorneys that would just put a little time in pro bono and kind of work with the community to have some examples of, you know, what is illegal activity. And the community probably has a lot of examples of things that have been happening that probably needs to be merged or married with how that translates into, you know, what kind of lawbreaking. Because there probably are analogies in economic crimes and organized crime and other areas. It's just not around energy. So I'm just putting out some ideas. And, you know, part of it is educating law enforcement about what this is all about and why there is a high, you know, big stakes here and why people will be motivated. Because if they just think it's an isolated inventor doing his or her own thing, you know, they always look for motive. It's one thing law enforcement is always looking for is motive. So, you know, if it doesn't click to them as to why somebody would be bothering somebody or threatening somebody, then that's one, you know, thing they're gonna, that's one thing that's kind of missing from their equation. But then it needs to be put into, I think, in enough of their language, you know, in terms of that they can relate to in terms of you know, types of criminal activity that have been witnessed or demonstrated or reported in this sector over the last, well, you know, 10 or 20 years or maybe longer.
Okay,
and then, so that's a couple of pieces. So I don't know if somebody's already prepared that, great. But it's a little bit different. It could draw on the document. Once I see it, I could give an opinion. It perhaps could draw on and from the document that you're referring to, but it may require some reworking and, you know, presenting in a different way. Then we get to the evidentiary side. And, you know, I don't know if it's in the draft you're referring to, the draft that's for new energy research inventors and entrepreneurs, but another piece of that is documenting and reporting threats and interference. Okay? And tell me if I'm repeating what other people around they've covered.
No, we haven't really discussed the specifics of how
they're so,
cover the roles.
You know, I'm just giving my impression. From my experience, most of the new energy inventors, researchers, and entrepreneurs are not experienced at this. They're not experienced dealing with law enforcement. They're not experienced, or they don't, you know, they haven't been prepared about what you need to do if something is happening or has happened, or if you expect to, you know, you have some warning, you know, what you need to do to capture that information. Because law enforcement, motive is important to them. What's at stake is important, but also the evidence is important. And that's, you know, that applies, doesn't matter what the area is, whether it's new energy or any other area. So anyway, I mean, guess I'm thinking that that evidence collection and documentation needs to be addressed in the document that would be prepared for the new energy community people. But, you know, the thing, if there's some document, educational document for law enforcement, could also reinforce, you know, what it is, you know, how do you get the most mileage out of when things do happen? How do you make the evidence as credible as possible?
Right. Yeah, there has to be some sort of centralized information gathering mechanism where advanced energy researchers and inventors, as well as the people who try to fund them, they've got to know where to go in case something out of the ordinary happens.
Yeah, so what I feel like there's been enough experience from the Gary Vesperman document and, you know, other reports and accounts that a fairly good list of types, you know, of it doesn't have to be naming specific, but, you know, pulling from that, extracting a matrix of types of threats and interferences, okay, that have happened. I'm not saying there are some that haven't, but, I mean, there's a lot of stuff has been reported or alleged to have happened, you know, and then that would be part of the document that goes to the new energy community. But then the next part of it is, well, what do you do about that? So part of it is reporting, okay? If something, you get a suspicious call, if you haven't been able to record it, at least take the notes right away, write up a transcript, you know, of the call. I'm just giving you an example of it. Obviously, if there's any type of suspicious behavior, vehicles or whatever, take photos. Or even if you don't, at least write down right away, because the police, law enforcement understands that eyewitness reports fade over time, and they really like to get that captured. And if they can't do it themselves, if somebody says, at least, you know, another thing is recording. If you had a call, threatening call, or is actually, but it wasn't recorded directly, but the person would make a tape recording, him or herself, right as soon as possible, while it's still fresh.
Right.
Okay, so you go down the line, you know, you try to figure out, well, this is the ideal, but if you can't do that, then do this. It's really, really important, because you know, the FBI really is something I know a little bit about, but, you know, they have their, they're really aware that, you know, eyewitness reports, including people reporting on themselves, you know, experiences they've had themselves, are, you know, you can't ever count on them being 100%, but if you don't get to them fast, before time has passed, before they've been, had conversations with other people, and, you know, then the likelihood of that still being an accurate report goes down, 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 down. And then you have media and all sorts of other things come in.
Right.
So anyway, that's just probably a general theme in that, is just trying to capture that information when it's fresh. Okay? And you'd have to kind of go through the different... Now, another aspect of that is when and how to engage law enforcement. Because, you know, what are the type of things that really do need to be reported? What are the type of things you want to keep a record of? And if you start seeing a pattern, then you report it, etc. So those are the type of some of the type of topics I think that need to be covered somehow.
Here's Late Night Leroy. I think we know who that is. I got an inventor that submitted a text message who is asking how an inventor overcomes a do not investigate order from some high up politician in Washington. And what we're doing is establishing an independent repository of information and a network of people who would investigate incidents similar to how private people, you know, just everyday citizens, independently investigate advanced energy technologies when they hear about them. It would be the same sort of process. You have a group of volunteers initially until it's funded, who, when there's an incident reported that something out of the ordinary has happened to an inventor, somebody's been interfering with their work, whatever, and we simply collaborate informally until, again, there's sufficient funding in place, or until government officials step up to the plate and do what they're supposed to do. For now, that's where we're at. So the question is, how do we move forward from just independent initiatives to getting the government to work for us instead of against us?
Just to elaborate, I mean, I think that there's several aspects to this, but again, part of it is being proactive. It's really hard to investigate the older cases, but, you know, trying to at least do what we can and then try to make the future better. So there's a proactive aspect, because it's a new area, it probably takes more effort than otherwise. But I also think it's important to, to figure out how to involve, the law enforcement. I'm using that term broadly, appropriate law enforcement. If any type of situation, really gets serious, and if there's really, good evidence of a serious threat situation, I just want to, at least my view is, I'm not, recommending that I anyway, take over the law enforcement function. I think what it is an intelligence function. I mean, it's an educational function, but as far as what you're mentioning, Todd, I mean, that's, since there isn't anybody that I know of anyway at least in the federal government that's, or state, local, I'm not aware of any law enforcement entity that's comprehensively monitoring this area.
Right.
It would be nice if, yeah, so that, basically by both trying to help people protect themselves on the ground and be able to get effective law enforcement assistance when they need it, but you're also talking about looking at the bigger picture, and I assume that's what you're alluding to, and then being able to, put all the pieces together and look for larger patterns, and if, depending on what emerges there, I mean, that's something that has some, additional persuasiveness. Is that what you're talking about?
For the most part, yeah, we're just trying to figure out a way to connect the dots between people that are experiencing this type of suppression and the law enforcement, the federal agencies, who have a stake, who are adversely affected by allowing these incidents to go unreported, to include possible orders to not investigate. And I've heard about this before, and based on the research I've done, that probably does happen. I'm reasonably certain those orders are given at a certain level of bureaucracy and an investigation stops, which shouldn't happen. So it's a question of how do we get the white hats on board to overcome the disruption that the black hats are creating? And the only way to do that is just hearts and minds, just work with people, get people on board one at a time until you have a critical mass of support. And once there's too much attention paid to this type of interference, it will have to curtail, otherwise the parties responsible for that interference will be uncovered, and then they get to spend lots of time in jail. That would be the end state that we're looking for.
I just to give a commentary on that area, I couldn't speak to whether or not there have been incidents when elements of law enforcement have been directed not to investigate situations of alleged harassment or threats to new energy researchers. But what I do think that in general, if a crime is being committed, in general, I would believe that most law enforcement, if they can be persuaded it's a credible situation, they're going to at least feel they have some responsibility. That would be my opinion. That doesn't mean there aren't situations like what you're referring to, but I certainly have no knowledge of a blanket, direction to the U.S. federal, state, local law enforcement to, not to investigate New Energy cases.
Yeah, I don't think it's that overt where there's some memo that was distributed to, local, state, and federal enforcement. No, it's a sort of situation where it's just pinpointed where when an investigation begins, essentially the party responsible for interfering with a researcher's work contacts some of their buddies on the investigative side of the fence and they say, listen, just let it go, okay? That happens. There's no question.
Yeah, well, all that stuff is in itself, to the extent that any of that there's interference of that sort, that's criminal activity in and of itself.
Yes, it is.
I mean, it's high risk. So anyway, I think the way you're headed, which I think makes sense, is trying to get a higher public profile on the whole field, getting a higher profile on the sudden interference activity. And I mean, I think if if the community is able to pull that information together in a persuasive way, some elements, it would be my opinion, of law enforcement will pay attention. Now, I'm not going to say all, but and I also think that, if individual incidents, the people involved are better prepared in how to document and report this, that will have a positive effect. I can't guarantee how these things would, the outcome of it, but, that's my opinion.
Well, the one example where law enforcement did help an inventor was when a gentleman had the two, men in black yahoos show up on his doorstep. They get into his office, they kick him out of his office, and little did they know that the deadbolt that locked on both sides could only be unlocked from the inside with a key. So he basically, when he got kicked out, he locked the door from the outside. These idiots couldn't get out, so he called the police, had them arrested. They tried to, pull their fake badges on the cop, and the cop said, yeah, whatever, let's go. So he ended up hauling him to jail anyway. That's pretty rare. Usually it's something out in the open where, it's like one inventor versus four guys with Uzis, or, something where the inventor's at a distinct disadvantage. And it's at somewhere where by the time the police show up, it's already over, So that's a little bit frustration that I'm expressing on behalf of some of these researchers who have had to deal with this. And it happens fairly frequently. And if that weren't the case, these technologies would be getting out to the public, and they're not.
Okay, well, anyway, the goal would be to, it seems to me, that that this area gets on the radar. I mean, to me anyway, to get this on the radar screen in an accepted way, in a credible way, with law enforcement in the areas where there are people with issues, and try to prepare materials, prepare the researchers and inventors and entrepreneurs, educate them about all this, try to maximize their ability both to protect themselves, but if stuff happens, to be able to document and record it, to put themselves in the strongest position when they do bring it to law enforcement. And maybe there needs to be a roving support team or something, to help to make sure that people do this in the strongest possible way, and then document if there's these issues with law enforcement apparently not taking it seriously, or even worse, which would be if somebody's waving them off. Those things need to be recorded too. But if there's a pattern of that, you know, there's more power in it. If it's not just like have an isolated instance and doesn't happen very much, but if you're suggesting that there's a pattern of that, I mean, that's a very serious matter. And I'm going to believe that, you know, there's going to be people somewhere, someplace in law enforcement who would be very concerned about that. If there's actually people, in, you know, interceding in the investigative process and waving people off. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, and I'm not saying it certainly it doesn't happen in other sectors, but, you know, the test to me is if somebody really put together the documentation and went to, you know, an appropriate senior law enforcement people and see how they react to it. But, right. You know.
Well, one instance is the inventor out in Fresno. I'm reasonably certain the FBI is not investigating ongoing interference that individual is having to deal with right now.
Yeah, you just... yeah, right. You know, I mean, it's not perfect. I certainly agree with that. But, you know, I'm just hoping that the vast preponderance of law enforcement want to do the right thing, but that they just don't have the awareness, they don't have the mind, you know, the frame of reference, and they don't have the what they consider to be, you know, sufficiently documented evidence or whatnot.
Yeah.
And they may not understand the motive. You know, I mean, you know, maybe I'm being overly optimistic, but I'd like to hope that I'm right about that.
I agree. I believe most law enforcement personnel are there to do a good job and to actually protect. But when you get to the point where it's an FBI investigation, you're entering a bureaucracy that may be compromised to a certain extent. And if that weren't the case, these inventors wouldn't be suppressed. The FBI would be all over the party responsible for this type of interference. And to date, I haven't seen that type of action taken. So my only conclusion I can draw is that either they're unable to bring these parties to the forefront, you know, for prosecution, or they're just not doing the work to
okay, you know, I mean, I'm just speaking in generalities, but I mean, sure. I think a issue is whether this area, you know, at least it'd be my impression, and I mentioned what I said before, that, you know, this new energy area is not very much understood or even recognized, and it can, you know, some people may mix it up with magic or, you know, off the wall sort of things. I don't know, you know, new age, whatever. You know, I mean, I think a partial explanation is it's just not, you know, a bank robbery or a car theft or, you know, any number of other things or white collar, you know, type of financial crimes. You know, there's a whole list of things that they're already programmed, you know, to deal with. That's what I'm kind of saying is part of it.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to fall into anybody's normal line of duty, although the FBI is actually responsible for investigating these incidents. I know that because a lot of the counterproliferation work falls in their arena, and this isn't this this type of, it's just very similar. I mean, this is an FBI area.
If there's interstate, and it's certainly possible, that kind of depends on who's behind all this, but you know, any type of if this rises to the level of interstate criminal activity, you know, that's one way to get in. There's a lot of different ways for law enforcement to a certain jurisdiction and, or have jurisdiction, and I certainly think it's likely there's a lot of angles the FBI could get in on this, but the thing is, that's like if it is understood to be a real area.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah,
I mean, that's
kind of
the mindset issue. It's the biggest problem, and in a way it's the biggest problem, because if somebody says or reports threatening or you know, activity that could be considered criminal, I'm saying short of being somebody gets shot, okay? But, you know, but if it's coming out of an area that, you know, if it's not black and white, let's say, you know, and it's coming out of an area that it just doesn't, it doesn't mean anything to them. To me, anyway, that's a problem. Yeah. Whether or not that's, I'm not defending it, I'm just, you know, analyzing it. The other thing is, from what my understanding of it is, it, you know, there's, it could be, you know, somebody could be really looking at all the angles here, so it's a pretty sophisticated interference operation.
Probably the most sophisticated that the FBI has ever had to deal with, and to date has been unable to effectively overcome. That's saying something.
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, maybe this effort, again, I'm the ultimate optimist or something or other, but I mean, the type of materials and information that you're talking about developing, and or maybe it's already been partially prepared, maybe that would give a better basis, or at least would help the FBI and others to, you know, be more understanding and more proactive and more effective.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm not seeing that there's a, I mean, there's only something to gain, and the question is there any downside to the initiatives that we've been discussing and that you've been proposing? At least,
the downside, I think, would be to organize the event and then not reach a critical mass of people. That way, you know, the people involved in organizing, those speaking, all that, would look back on the event and say, well, that didn't accomplish anything. Now what do we do? So that's what I do not want to have happen. And the question is, do we have a critical mass of support to move forward in order to reach a critical mass of Americans, of law enforcement, federal agency personnel, etc.? So I don't know how to answer that question. And until I can get a pretty firm answer, I don't feel comfortable moving forward towards a full-blown disclosure event.
So I guess, I don't know the answer either.
Yeah.
I do. I'm saying that conceptually it makes sense to me, the directions that you've outlined, and obviously the suggestions that I've made make sense to me.
Yeah,
sense. Otherwise I wouldn't have said them. But the thing, I guess you're putting out a call, or you're going to put out a call to find, I mean, what I mean is, it's like a call for papers or a call for participants, and find out what the extent of people, of new energy inventors, researchers, and entrepreneurs are interested in being part of this. Is that what
Precisely.
Your plan is?
Precisely. That's exactly what's happening this weekend. I'm using this as a forum to determine whether or not we can move forward. And the fact that this came together so quickly with so much support, and here we have over 1,100 people just listening to us, that leads me to believe that it is time. So it's just a matter of logistics, you know. Where do we schedule the event? Who's going to be directly responsible for organizing it? Who will be invited? How do we organize the disclosure presentations, etc.? So those are just admin issues as far as I'm concerned.
Right, and so I'm just going to make a final comment Because I guess the hour is up and you've got other people.
Yeah, Gene Manning will be on at 2 o'clock here.
So. Yeah, I don't want to cut into other people's time, but I just want to close on a positive note.
Yep.
Again, I was at a 2-day workshop with a lot of people that do a lot of hard thinking about the global U.S. and global futures, all sectors. They are very interested. They understand energy is critically important. They don't know much about the new energy, but they're very interested, and I think a lot of other people would be too if you can crack through on it.
All right.
So I think all this stuff would help move in that direction.
Okay.
Todd, thank you very much for having me.
All right, thank you.
All right, I'll see if I can tune in on the internet and listen in on some of the other discussion.
Okay.
Thank you for taking the initiative. It's a very important weekend in the new energy area, and my best to all the other speakers.
All right, thanks.
Okay, we'll see you.
Right.
Thanks, bye-bye.
All right, the next caller, speaker rather, is Jean Manning, and she's done a book on advanced energy, so I'll give her a call right now. And this will be a 1-hour interview.